Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, yet another song theft case. You got it. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when 260 scientists, medical professionals, professors, and science communicators did not object to this podcast being made available on Spotify, which I think is a ringing endorsement for everything we do.
Maybe we should get that on our social media as our little bio. The podcast that has not been criticized strongly by 260 scientists and medical professionals. Although it has to be said that every single podcast in the world, bar one, could also have that in their official blurbs. But actually, I think they should. I think every podcaster in the world should update their official blurbs to say that, with the exception of the one which cannot.
Yes, we're talking about the Joe Rogan Experience, which did prompt 260 scientists, medical professionals, professors, and science communicators to write to Spotify and say, why are you letting this man put about so much COVID misinformation?
Yeah, that was the complaint aimed at Spotify specifically, because of course, the Joe Rogan Experience, biggest podcast in the world, am I right in saying that?
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of people listen to it. They reckon 11 million people every episode.
But of course, the reason why this letter has gone specifically to Spotify, criticising the fact that over the last couple of years, Joe Rogan has had a lot of chatter and waffle and guests spreading various different conspiracy theories relating to COVID. But of course, Spotify is feeling the heat because the Joe Rogan Experience is these days an exclusive Spotify podcast. I think you can still get clips on YouTube, can't you? But if you want the full experience, and who wouldn't? Well, me, but quite a lot of people do want the full experience, and you have to have that on Spotify. And I suppose it's interesting. I mean, obviously, you could say, well, this isn't technically a music industry news story. Why are you talking about it on Setlist? But I suppose because Spotify has not only made podcasts a really important part of its proposition, as well as music, but it's actually started taking exclusivity deals with podcasters and creating its own podcasts, which means Spotify has, in essence, now become a media company, even though we still count it as music news because it's Spotify. But as a media company, they then get all these issues around you're giving biased, controversial misinformation. Shouldn't you be having some balance? Shouldn't you be... Well, some would say they're calling for outright censorship, but I think they're probably calling for what I guess a regulated broadcaster like we have here in the UK, if you're going to have a controversial guest saying that the COVID vaccine is really damaging to certain people, you shouldn't take the vaccine, you should do other things, that you would at the very least have another scientist on the program to counter all of that.
Yeah, and this isn't the first time that Spotify's tie-up with Joe Rogan's been controversial. I mean, it's been controversial pretty much since that deal was announced. There's regular stories about Spotify staff not being happy about this alignment. And I mean, I guess in his defense, Joe Rogan would probably say he's just listening to alternative points of view, putting about alternative arguments. But as you say, he doesn't have a scientist on there with someone who's spouting COVID conspiracies. I mean, he doesn't particularly challenge people. He's not the world's best interviewer. In terms of stamina, he can interview people for a really long time. He's very good at that. But I think actually doing the job of interviewing, he sort of falls down. I mean, he's not a journalist, is he?
And I don't listen to the podcast, so I'm not really in a position to comment on how he has been presenting these various sort of COVID conspiracy theories and vaccine criticisms. Although I did watch a YouTube video of someone critiquing his most recent commentaries and guests covering this topic. Now, it may be that YouTube video was biased in the clips that they were selecting, but he did just seem to be reading off a list of various COVID conspiracy theories without really questioning them or saying this seems a little bit suspect or this isn't backed up by science. He did just seem to be reading them out. Maybe that was an unfair portrayal of what it's like, but certainly from the letter that was written to Spotify this week, they are suggesting that there have been a number of editions of that podcast in recent times where he has basically presented those conspiracy theories without any critique, and that that's a bad thing. And they're sort of saying that Spotify, in essence, as a media company now, should be more clear in what its policies are regarding that kind of content and what it does where there are accusations of outright misinformation, etc., etc. So not technically a music industry story, but Spotify, so therefore we're counting it, and an interesting development. But I should say, as interesting as that story is, not only is that not a story we're here to cover on this week's set list, it's not even the Spotify story we're here to cover on this week's set list.
No, later on we'll be discussing Spotify's successful effort to block a cannabis company from trademarking a very similar name. But first, judges in the US Ninth Circuit Appeals Court last week maintained a sceptical position regarding extending copyright protection to short segments of music. This has come up again because the Christian rapper Marcus Gray is trying to get a ruling in his song theft case against Katy Perry overturned.
Yes, so this is the long-running song theft legal battle in relation to the Katy Perry hit Dark Horse. It's still rumbling on because it's now in the appeal courts. So we should start off by just very quickly recapping the story so far, even though we have talked about it before on Setlist and written about it loads in the CMU Daily. But just to recap everybody. So this guy, Marcus Gray, he accuses Katy Perry and her collaborators on Dark Horse of ripping off his earlier track called Joyful Noise. And basically, these two songs, Joyful Noise and Dark Horse, they do have a certain thing in common, which basically is a repeating ostinato, which was described in one of the legal filings by Katy Perry's side as being merely two pitches that repeat a C and B note on evenly spaced notes in a sparse setting played on a synthesizer. Now, the fact that these two songs both use the same ostinato and they repeat it, that isn't disputed. So this is another one of those cases that we've seen over the years, and particularly in recent years, in the American courts, where you have two songs that do have something in common, a musical segment that is used frequently in both the songs, but then we end up getting into the big debate about, well, hang on a second, actually, what these two songs have in common is a relatively small segment of music, albeit one that is then repeated in the track. But can that little segment of music in isolation possibly be protected by copyright? Should it be? Shouldn't it be? And obviously, in recent years, when it comes to song theft cases, well, I guess it all kicks off with the Blurred Lines case, where we had Blurred Lines and the Marvin Gaye track Got to Give It Up that it was accused of ripping off. And that was a case where people said, okay, yeah, there are certain musical segments in common in these two tracks, but they are ultimately different tracks, even though they have certain similarities and a similar vibe. So can we possibly say there's a case for copyright infringement here? Obviously, in the Blurred Lines case, the conclusion was, yes, they are similar enough for there to be copyright infringement. And then we've had a whole load of other cases. But the reason why it's interesting seeing what's happening in the appeal court on the Katy Perry case is, since the Blurred Lines ruling, we had the Stairway to Heaven ruling, which seemingly contrasted what happened in the Blurred Lines case. And in a way, the Dark Horse case is now testing whether or not the US courts are willing to say that short musical segments should be protected by copyright, and therefore, when you have two songs that use the same musical segment in a similar way, the newer song is ripping off the older song.
Yeah, so in the first instance, Gray was successful in convincing a jury that Dark Horse did infringe his copyright. And as a result, Perry and the other songwriters on the track were ordered to pay Gray $2.8 million in damages. So that was good for Gray. But then the judge overseeing the case, Christina Snyder, overturned the jury's decision on the basis that the grey size arguments that the shared ostinato was protected by copyright in isolation failed as a matter of law. And as you mentioned, that decision came shortly after the Ninth Circuit Appeal Court's ruling on the Stairway to Heaven song theft case, which arguably set a precedent on the copyright status of short musical segments and concluded that they don't usually have copyright protection. So good for Perry, that worked out. And I mean, see, when a precedent's been set, that would seem to be the end of the matter. But Marcus Gray has carried on with this and he's carrying on all the way. But the Ninth Circuit doesn't seem that keen to go with him.
Yeah. So because of the court that Gray originally filed his lawsuit in sits under the Ninth Circuit in the American court system, so therefore the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court. So yeah, it means that in order to appeal the original ruling where the judge overturned what the jury had decided regarding whether or not Dark Horse infringed Joyful Noise, in essence, the judge in the lower court was very much influenced, it seemed, by the Ninth Circuit ruling in the Stairway to Heaven case, in which the appeals court very much was saying, yeah, there's a few notes in common between these two songs, Stairway to Heaven and the song it was accused of ripping off, but they can't be protected by copyright in isolation. And in that ruling, there was an element of the judges saying, you know, where do you draw the line? If you start saying these few notes are protected by copyright, surely that's going to have a negative impact on the songwriting process. We can't have that in copyright law. So that was what the Ninth Circuit said in the Stairway to Heaven case. That seemed to heavily influence the judge in the Dark Horse case. And now, in order to appeal the judge overturning the jury ruling, Gray has to go back to the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court, to the same judges who ruled the way they did in the Stairway to Heaven case, set the precedent that they did in the Stairway to Heaven case, to try and argue that whatever happened in the Stairway case, this case is different.
Yeah, so legal reps for Gray told the appeal judges that the jury had seen extensive evidence and heard detailed expert testimony during the original hearing in the lower court, and therefore Snyder was wrong to simply ignore their conclusion. However, those appeal judges responded, when it comes to the so-called extrinsic test in copyright cases, which includes identifying what elements of a piece of music or a song are not actually protected by copyright in isolation, judges rather than juries are the key decision makers. And the appeal judge, Milan Smith, said, it seems to me that the case law says that we as judges are fully authorised and empowered and indeed required to examine the extrinsic test ourselves.
Now, Gray's legal reps in court conceded that the appeals judge was correct in saying that when it comes to this extrinsic test, the judge does basically take the lead there in deciding which elements of a work are protected by copyright. However, he then tried to argue that while Snyder may have had the right and the power and maybe even the responsibility to make that call, she basically made some errors in applying this test. In particular, said Gray's lawyer, Snyder failed to consider the qualitative importance of the musical segment that Joyful Noise and Dark Horse have in common, which, he argued, can actually impact on whether there is a case for saying that one work infringes another. And to then try and prove just how important this relatively small musical segment is to Dark Horse, he then started talking about how when Katy Perry performed the song at the 2015 Super Bowl halftime show, she actually skipped the introduction of the track, went straight to the repeating ostinato, and when asked about why she'd made that decision for the Super Bowl show, Perry said, oh, well, that's the bit of the song everybody knows, everybody recognizes. She actually talked about it being the chorus and the hook, which are obviously slightly more common terms in pop music. And Gray's lawyer was basically trying to say, see, that proves that ostinato is incredibly important to Dark Horse, and that should have an impact on whether or not we think that that segment in itself should be protected by copyright in order to say that there is infringement, said Gray's team. The Perry side then countered by saying, okay, yes, the ostinato is part of the chorus, but when Perry said, oh, well, that's the most important part of the track, she didn't just mean the ostinato. She meant the entire chorus, the entire hook of the song. So therefore, nobody should take any attention to that, said Perry's side. And so back and forth was happening in the Ninth Circuit. But it has to be said, no judgment was made, we should stress. So it could be as yet that the appeals court agrees to overturn the lower court ruling and maybe reinstate the jury ruling or send it back to court for another hearing. But other comments that were made on the day seem to suggest that the judges in the appeals court feel that they got it right on the Stairway to Heaven case, that we do need to be careful. We, what am I talking about? They need to be careful. Not my problem. They need to be careful about overextending copyright in cases like this, where you have songs that have certain little elements in common, but no more. They got it right in the Stairway to Heaven case, and they don't want to, in essence, affect the impact of that precedent by ruling in Gray's favour here.
Yeah, one of the other judges in the Ninth Circuit, Richard R. Clifton, admitted he's no expert in pop music, but said it had taken him several listens of the two songs to figure out exactly what the purported similarities were. After the first couple of listens, he said, I really had to focus to try to figure out what little short segment matches in the same way. It took enough work that I began to wonder, how exactly does that become something protectable?
So another judge in the Ninth Circuit, implying that they're not likely to side with Gray on this one, despite the jury ruling in the original case when it was in court. So it could be that in the relatively near future, we get a ruling in the Ninth Circuit on that case that seems to suggest that when it comes to songs having a few notes in common, I mean, you could try pursuing cases elsewhere in the US that aren't technically under the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court, but I think that will seemingly set a precedent that, yeah, where songs have a few notes in common, you're going to struggle to stake a claim for copyright infringement. Of course, there's another case that's working its way through the courts that's been very long running, similar but slightly different, which is the Taylor Swift Shake It Off song theft case. The reason why that's slightly different is that is more around lyrical similarity than sort of musical similarity, although same thing, that it's just a handful of words that the two songs have in common, and they're relatively common phrases. So similar thing of saying, you know, a handful of words, particularly if it's a common phrase, surely can't be protected by copyright in isolation. So I don't know how long that case is going to take. It's taken so long to get to where we are because the Taylor Swift side have been desperately trying to get it dismissed on summary judgment, so far without success. But I mean, it could be if Katy Perry ultimately prevails on this case and Taylor Swift on the sort of more lyric focused case, then we've got a couple of, you know, strong precedents there, following from the Stairway to Heaven precedent, that you're going to struggle to prove copyright infringement where you have two songs that just share a musical segment or a handful of words. You've got to have more substance to have an infringement case. But it has to be said, in the meantime, that's not stopping more of these song theft lawsuits from being filed in the American courts.
No, they just keep coming. And there's one other we wanted to discuss this week, which was a case against Chris Brown and Drake over their 2019 track, No Guidance. They were actually sued last year by singer Brendan Cooper and producer Timothy Valentine. So the development this week was that Chris Brown and Drake were responding, saying that the whole thing is baseless and that there's no plausible case for suggesting that their 2019 track rips off this 2016 track, I Love Your Dress, which is what that's what they're accused of stealing from. What specifically they're accused of ripping off is a lyrical phrase, like in that Taylor Swift case. In this case, it's the words, you got it.
Yeah, although we should stress, it brings us no pleasure to be standing up for Chris Brown and Drake in a lawsuit of this kind. This case does seem particularly flimsy. This is being pursued through the courts in Florida, which technically does not sit under the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court. But it definitely has parallels with the Shake It Off case because a shared lyric is sitting at the heart of it. Although they do then have some slightly more vague, waffly claims about some musical similarities between the two tracks as well. So there's also a parallel with the Dark Horse case. But I think the main reason for mentioning this is, yeah, it's kind of a funny case in that, I mean, unless we're missing something, and who knows if the case does proceed, maybe more information will come to light. But it does seem quite flimsy because, yeah, the main similarity between the two songs is that they both have the lyric, "You got it." But I mean, that's a pretty common expression. I mean, first of all, it was a Burger King slogan for a time. Also, Roy Orbison wrote a song called "You Got It" that has the repeated lyric, "You got it." So I think to suggest that some serious song theft, plagiarism, copyright infringement is going on that free word lyric alone does seem rather ambitious.
I think that they actually ripped off the Jack D stand-up routine in the 90s about the Burger King slogan. I think Jack D should be suing them.
Almost certainly so. I think that seems, well, I told you, that sounds no more outlandish than this legal claim. of course, the other thing that you have to have in lawsuits where you're accusing somebody of ripping off an earlier song or an earlier track, not only do you have to try and prove that two tracks are similar enough for there to be a case for copyright infringement, you also have to prove that the people who wrote the newer work were exposed to the earlier work in some way so that they had an opportunity to rip it off. So there's usually some labored explanation of how that might have happened in these cases. And
that's no different here.
It quite often involves, oh, I showed my music to someone who works in the music industry and they must have passed it on to Superstar X. And that is basically what's claimed in this case.
Yeah, so Cooper and Valentine say that they sent a link to the album on which their track, I Love Your Dress, appears to an A&R rep who was associated with Drake's then label Cash Money Records, who had actually approached Cooper to see if he had any music that, you know, they could work together on. And from that, they've extrapolated that it was obviously then passed on to Drake, and him and Brown ripped it off, not caring that someone else had already put all the hard work into coming up with the words, "You got it." And, well, now here we are.
Yes, indeed, here we are. So some quite firm quotes, as you might have expected, in this new legal filing that was lodged with the court last week, in which Drake and Chris Brown are seeking to have this case dismissed. They say that Cooper and Valentine's lawsuit is premised upon the alleged similarity between the wholly generic lyrical phrase, "You got it," and the alleged similar and unoriginal theme of a hardworking, attractive woman. Yeah, there was also a claim that the theme of the two songs was quite similar as well. But as the lawsuit says, no one, including plaintiffs, can own or monopolize the non-copyrightable phrase, "You got it," and it should come as no surprise that this phrase appears in countless other works. Also, lyrical themes are simply unprotectable as a matter of law.
Yeah, and as for the claims about how Chris Brown and Drake got to allegedly hear this song, they say, "A charitable read of the complaint is that plaintiffs gave their song to someone in the music business who might have known someone who knows one of the defendants involved in the creation of defendants' works, but that plaintiffs have no idea who that person might be, whether it actually happened or when it happened."
And with all of that in mind, Brown and Drake and the various other co-defendants on the case are basically saying to the court in Florida, just kick this out as soon as you can. I suspect the court probably will, but we will see. Meanwhile, I guess in terms of us getting some solid precedence on the whole song theft thing, it is the Dark Horse case focused on some musical notes in common and the Shake It Off case focused on some lyrics in common. Those are going to be the two big judgments that we should see maybe in the next year or a little bit longer that could provide some clarity. The clarity basically being, hey, lawyers of America, when two songs have a few notes or a few words in common, stop filing nonsense lawsuits. That's just the music making process.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, as promised, it's back to Spotify and more court news as well. So everyone's happy. Last week, the US Trademark Trial and Appeal Board sided with Spotify in a trademark dispute with an American software company that has developed a platform via which legal marijuana dispensaries can market and sell their products. And that platform is called Potify.
Of course it is. It's a platform that helps people buy pot. Why wouldn't you want to call that Podify when you're launching a few years after Spotify launched in the US market as a major digital music service?
But, and this is very important, the CEO of this software company, US Software Inc., Ghassan Suleymanov, is keen for everyone to know that in coming up with the name Spotify, he did not think of Spotify or anything associated with Spotify. The Spotify name did not come to mind when developing the name for Spotify. Because why would it? Why would it? You wouldn't ever conflate those two things, would you?
Of course not. Another reason why we're talking about this particular legal battle, a bit like the Chris Brown Drake one, is it's just quite amusing. So this Spotify service was launched in 2017, but they started working on it in 2014. But that's still 3 years after Spotify's launch in the US. And of course, Spotify was live in Europe a few years before that. And actually, in the ruling that was published by the trademark board last week, there was a big section where they were basically saying not only were the bosses of this company, US Software Inc., surely, clearly aware of Spotify's existence, because obviously when it launched in the US, it got a lot of press and a lot of coverage. But actually, we don't even have to assume that because of all of the coverage around Spotify's launch that they would know about it, because the CEO guy was a Spotify subscriber. So clearly was aware of Spotify. So yeah, the question was, is it believable that a Spotify subscriber who came up with this marijuana-based digital platform didn't think of Spotify when coming up with the brand name Spotify? He was also quite keen to stress, obviously there are other EFI startups and digital companies and platforms out there. So he was honing in on Shopify, which I suppose as a platform that facilitates e-commerce, I think he was trying to say there's more similarities between Spotify and Shopify. And actually maybe that was what he was thinking about at the time. I mean, I don't know if that was him opening himself up to a trademark dispute with Shopify. I don't know.
Well, but then you've only got the EFI. Maybe three letters is easy.
Well, and that brings us to the other amusing part of this trademark board ruling, because there are various things that a trademark board needs to consider. I mean, the reason why this was before the board is because although Spotify has been operational for a while now, they haven't ever registered the Spotify trademark. They then decided that they wanted to do that. And this is what Spotify were formally objecting to. They didn't want to allow this company to own the Spotify trademark. Various things the trademark board has to consider when faced with a dispute like this, one of which is how similar are the two names, the name that's already a registered trademark and the one that's trying to be registered. And the analysis of that was quite amusing in the board's ruling.
Yes, the judge here, if you wonder if the judge was on the fence about this, he said in the hearing, the only difference between applicant's mark Spotify and opposer's mark Spotify is that opposer's starts with an S immediately before the shared letters Potify. In other words, as opposer points out, applicant merely deleted the leading S from opposer's mark. So yeah, it's pretty clear cut what the judge thinks.
The next question the judge then has to consider is how famous and distinct Spotify's brand is. And then finally, the important question, which is, will allowing the new similar mark to be registered have a negative impact on the existing mark? So the judge then started talking about how flipping famous Spotify is and was sort of saying, surely it's one of the most famous trademarks today. I mean, that must be good for Daniel Ek's ego.
Yes, I'm sure it was. I mean, I don't think he needs that, but why not? I mean, I'm sure he's scouring all of the court documents, looking for things to big himself up. And in this case, he's going to find that the judge said, there is no question that Spotify is as famous as marks come, that Spotify goods and services are widely used and recognised by a large percentage of the United States population, or that opposer's Spotify mark is highly distinctive. This was the case prior to applicant's claimed date of first use of its mark. Moreover, there is no evidence that any United States marks come as close to Spotify as applicant's Spotify mark. Opposer is understandably concerned and although we need only find likely dilution, we find it inevitable that Potify will diminish Spotify's distinctiveness.
And actually, that penultimate sentence there, which is there is no evidence that any United States marks come as close to Spotify as the applicant's Potify mark, that was also relevant because the other thing that the Potify legal team was saying is not only are there a number of other digital products with the IFI brand, there are actually quite a lot with the Otify brand. And they were basically arguing, well, if you won't let Potify to be trademarked because of Spotify, what about all these other brands that not only have IFI at the end of their name, they actually have Otify at the end of the name, and therefore this isn't a fair ruling, is what Potify's lawyers were trying to argue.
Well, yeah, but that, I mean, the examples they came up with all do have Otify in it. I mean, for the most part, they're not pronounced Otify. There's Clotify, Votify, and Notify. You can't have a company called Notify because it's too much like Spotify. I mean, I don't think that's a flimsy argument. But the attorney for Potify, Kevin Davis, told Law 360 afterwards that the board's decision was clearly based on the fame of the Spotify brand, which resulted in an overly broad protection of their brand.
So there you go. This was the week when in the courts, on the copyright side, judges were trying to be more narrow in extending copyright protection. Meanwhile, on the trademark side, if you believe Potify's lawyers, they were overextending trademark protection and stopping good, honest marijuana sellers from ripping off the name, possibly of a quite popular streaming service.
But that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. You can find links to everything we've discussed on this week's show, maybe even that Jack D routine if I can find it, in the show notes for this episode, which you'll find in your podcast player right now or at setlistpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show if you aren't already, so you will get new episodes delivered to you automatically every single week. Every single week that we put out an episode, which is most weeks, so let's just stick with every single week. Don't forget to rate and review the show anywhere that that's possible. If you want to email us about anything, maybe that we've discussed in this episode or any other time or anything at all, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. We didn't actually, I think just before Christmas, I asked old people to email in to see if we had any old listeners. And quite a few did. And they sent in really long, really well thought out emails, which I haven't responded to. But thank you very much for all those emails. We did read them. But we had the Christmas break and then forgot to mention it on last week's episode. But keep emailing in because we do actually like receiving emails to the Setlist email address, unlike all of our other email addresses.
Yeah, and if you're looking for something you could email us about, if any American listeners are listening, that Burger King You Got It slogan, was that as big in the US as it was here in the UK? Because when I was looking that up, when I was writing the story, the only adverts I could find on YouTube of Burger King with that slogan were all UK adverts. So maybe it wasn't as big in the US. So therefore...
Well, Burger King's slogan was have it your way, wasn't it? I think that was global. But maybe the You Got It thing was just here.
I couldn't find any American ads because I wanted to accuse...
Because wasn't it like the premise was... At Burger King, I mean, it was before you were allowed to badmouth other companies and adverts, but the idea was at Burger King, unlike McDonald's, you can have your burger however you want it, so long as you want it entirely tasteless, which, I mean, possibly that was the thrust of that Jack D routine. But anyway, I mean, you couldn't go in and ask for it medium rare and to have flavour, so I think that's probably why they dropped that tagline. I don't know. It was a long time ago.
But my point was, in my write-up of that, I wanted to accuse Drake and Chris Brown of being mainly influenced by Burger King in their lyrics rather than ripping off this other writer. But then I couldn't find any American versions with that slogan, so I couldn't do that. But I'm just interested if any American listeners, was that a big thing in the US like it was here in the UK? Was I right not to accuse Chris Brown and Drake of that in our write-up? Just ideas of why you might want to email us.
Okay, so that's what we want this week. Americans, please email in and tell us your memories of 90s Burger King adverts. Anyway, That is all we've got time for this week. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.